Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I want to begin by saying, who says you can't go home again? A.M. Holmes was on the show with her very first book of stories, The Safety of Objects. She now has, 30 years later, a new book of stories called Days of Awe. I would like you to tell what the Days of Awe are.
So the Days of Awe are the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in the Jewish religion. And it's a time of contemplation, and it's a time of making peace and reparations, really, and preparing oneself for the next year. And I was fascinated by that as a notion, because I also think we're living in a very strange time, and there's lots of meanings of the word awe. And so it's terror and, you know, epiphany. In many ways.
Awe and terror, that's what we offer our enemies.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying because that was once our relation to God, yes?
Absolutely.
And so in this story, the title story of the book, Days of Awe, the two characters, two Jews who are there at a conference, yes?
Absolutely.
They're there at a conference and they hardly expect to see each other that night at a temple, where both of them secretly have gone, one of them taking a $30 taxi to go to shul instead of attending the conference on terrorism and on genocides.
What's described as a transgressive novelist who could be mistaken for me, but it's not me, and a journalist are at a conference on genocides with the S in a parenthesis. And
capital S,
yes,
in parentheses.
Exactly, right. Which for me was really the idea, and so much of the story is about the ways in which if we ignore our history, and it's not Jewish history, it's world history really, the ways in which history repeats itself and the way in which war repeats itself. And in this book, there are several stories that really talk about the human cost of war and the echoes of war through multiple generations. So that's a piece of it. But it's also really about a hookup at a genocide conference.
Everyone is fighting a genocidal battle about how to define the reason of genocide and why it happens again and again. And yet as we read the story, we find out this is why it happens again and again, because they begin with a refusal to agree.
Well, and because everything is about competition and who gets a better room at the genocide convention and whose story of a genocide is more truthful and whose story is more legitimate. And we culturally now again are at an incredibly fascinating moment when we ask about who has the right to tell a particular story. And I'm always so interested in that because I think about how if we are to understand the experience of others and not just be so narcissistic and self-centered, we have to inhabit the experiences of others. And at the moment, we live in a society that's very fractured, and everybody is sure that their experience is the primary one and the legitimate one, and everybody else should basically be deported.
But in this, relatively speaking, early story in the book, mm-hmm. you see, they're arriving there. The Jews don't want to be Jews. They want to whisper to each other, I'm actually gay. And a woman comes up to the transgressive novelist who doesn't want to be a transgressive novelist and says, you're a gay, right? And the transgressive novelist doesn't know how to answer, but, you know, he doesn't tell me. A mother knows. And so all of these acts of self-definition
yeah.
are also at war with one another. And by the end of the story, now listen, If you think you can give away the end of a short story, short stories tend to be 40 pages long. Please forgive us all. You know, lift this curse from us, because the interest of the story is that the war correspondent and the lesbian woman who has never been in a war but is something of a transgressive novelist, they are going to be making love. The woman for the first time in many, many years with a man, the man for the definitely first time with a lesbian, and it is, you see, a story by a transgressive writer who's asking the reader to go on the attack while telling them why they shouldn't, yeah?
Absolutely. And in fact, the transgressive novelist says in the story that by naming her the transgressive novelist, what people are doing is saying, this is how we are different. This is how we separate ourselves from you. It is the way of saying, there's something about you that we don't necessarily approve of, and this is how we keep you in these labels. And it has, in the larger sense, nothing to do with a transgressive novelist or any of those other filing systems we use, but everything to do with how we have to make others different from ourselves and to not talk about what we have in common.
And what we watch in the story is how the reason that this conference has been called where? In New Hampshire. What are they going to get settled about terrorism in New Hampshire? You know, and yet they're looking for new directions.
Yes.
It's kind of an amazing story about the way we live now. And you have said that you write stories to show us how we live now.
I do. I think that stories are, you know, these sort of prisms and refractions in the sense that they allow us to kind of crack things open and show us back to ourselves in ways they may not be comfortable, but I think that allow us to see ourselves and see the ways that we make judgments and just the way we move through our lives a little bit with a kind of, you know, sometimes brutal clarity. I mean, I hate to say it about, you know, but there is a intensity to some of it.
Well, I want to go further than that.
Yeah.
You see, most of the people praising you as if they are looking for their American flag to wave,
yeah,
they don't go seven words without mentioning your compassion. And I feel like saying, so what? What if these stories don't have compassion?
Right.
What if they have intensity, meanness, and honesty? Where does compassion have to fit here, given this subject matter?
I would say that's true, but I think the compassion piece is important to me. I think it's important because often people will read my stories, including friends who I give them to early on, and say, am I supposed to like this guy? And I think, I don't care whether you like him. The idea of liking a character is such a truly modern idea and such a really bad one. You don't read Crime and Punishment and go, God, I love that guy. I can't wait to hang out with him. So that's so modern, and I don't care about that. But I do care about the characters. I care about who they are, what they want, what compels them.
I think you care about the honesty of your subject matter and that people have flaws and faults, no matter how good their positions are. And sometimes, no matter how virtuous they are, they're absolutely wrong.
Absolutely.
In the ways they think. And that these stories investigate the ways in which we hide behind certain excuses that allow us to generate compassion. I think compassion is a selfish desire on the part of people who refuse to change their ways. I'm going to get attacked for it. But you're not going to get attacked.
No, but do you think, because I think a lot about compassion towards others, and I actually, the other day, I was having a terrible day, and I was just basically a wreck, and I went to a mindfulness, you know, I walked in, and it was a mindfulness on loving, you know, meditation session, and it was on loving kindness. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, and I've studied that before, and it's all about, you know, how you turn your anger and hostility towards other into a positive feeling. But this one was about directing loving kindness towards yourself, which I thought, oh, uncomfortable. And how you can accept love or kindness from others. And I thought, oh, uncomfortable, things that are harder to do. But all that to say, I think a lot of it is also tolerating what you're saying, that people can be wonderful and ambitious and lively and great, and they can just suck and be terrible people and have lousy values and screw over other people and break hearts and all that at the same time.
I'm talking to A.M. Holmes about her book of stories called Days of Awe. It's published by Viking. I think if you were to go up to our late friend, Susan Sontag, and start talking about loving kindness, she would say, get away from me.
Exactly. She would think it was disgusting.
I'm interested in the life of the mind. I'm interested in what has happened to the world that has required that we have concepts like loving kindness when what we see around us is brutality and impossibility of speaking to one another. And I think, yes, compassion, a lot of people are saying it because they're so afraid of writing stories that are not going to make us feel good. But I want to say to you, A.M. Holmes, that your stories make me feel thrillingly sick.
Sorry.
Honest to God.
What are your symptoms?
Well, they're mentioned in the book, Butterflies in My Stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end, the final story in the book, which is called She Got Away, it deals with characters who appear in two stories.
Yes.
It's set in a very well-rendered, satiric Los Angeles. In the second of the stories, two parents have died, and no one knows what to do with them. Of course we don't know what to do. We don't want to bury them. They don't like it. They're claustrophobic. We don't want to burn them. Too much to do with witches, say. So what do? We bring them home. And what is the house good at? Climate control. So we can keep these dead bodies of the parents lying in the beds until someone can think of what to do. Maybe the dog will eat them. And it's a kind of astounding recognition. You didn't write that to be nice. You did it to have fun, to pull the leg of our inability to deal with death.
Well, that too. I mean, the funny thing about that story, and there's two, as you mentioned in the book, there's She Got Away, which is the last one, and the other one is called Hello, Everybody, and that came from, there's a class that little children take as infants called Music Together, and the song they sing is Hello, Everybody, and we're so pleased to meet you, and I was always convinced that in the future a spaceship will land and they'll play that song somehow and an entire generation will just flock on board without even asking questions. But the odder thing is that that character goes back to the first book of stories. She is the girl in Chunky and Heat. Her name is Cheryl. And she's in that story, and then in the second book of stories, she's in a story also set in Los Angeles called Raft in Water Floating. And it took me 30 years to basically write Cheryl from the time she was 13 till she's basically like a freshman in college. So I account for 10 years of her life over 30 years of mine.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
But it's about growing up. It's about also getting free and at what cost. The death of the family, the death of her parents.
It's not just those, but their inability to go to a restaurant together where any course will have more than 10 calories. And so the number of mousses and what do they call
foams?
They all eat things that come in pockets. It's astoundingly funny. The second to last, they call it penultimate story, is called Point Omega. It's a term that the Jesuit priest Pierre Teilhard de Chardin coined. It means the maximum level of complexity and consciousness toward which the universe appears to be evolving. Now, that maximum level of complexity is not an easy place to be or to live. It's once the easy solutions have disappeared, here comes point omega, where all the solutions are right and none of them are right.
Exactly.
Because, you see, there was an early specimen of man discovered in China. It was shipped to America, but when Pearl Harbor got bombed, the specimen, the bones, the pieces got lost somewhere, and we've never had them since. This is true, yes?
It's true. It was the bones of Peking man, and they were shipped for protection. The idea was that we were going to somehow protect them, and they were lost during the war and have never been located.
Now, in this story, Omega Point, the question is being asked, what if they, along with several other mysteries of Chinese history, were to be resolved just as terrorism is resolved in New Hampshire? This time, Peking Man has been being shipped clavicle by clavicle and bone by bone to a small town in Massachusetts.
North Adams, Massachusetts.
Yes.
Where Massmoca is now a museum, and it used to be the Sprague Electric Company, and before that it was a mill.
And a woman who's never told her daughter that she, the mother, is Chinese, and therefore the daughter is Chinese, and the granddaughter is too. And they've been getting boxes.
Yes.
Boxes in the mail for years and years, and now some Chinese people, including two acrobats, have come to fit together Peking Man. And when the statue is put together, as if in some Ionesco play, the grandmother begins to rise into the air. She is just disappearing from sight as the story ends. It's an astounding story. How does a story like this get conceived, let alone written?
Well, you know, one of the things that our late friend Susan Sontag would really appreciate is many of the stories in this book were written for artists. They were written either to go with exhibition catalogs or gallery shows. And I spent a lot of time, I used to sort of not work as an art critic, but I used to write art criticism. And I started spending time interviewing artists about why they made what they made, what they fed on to make it, and what it meant to them. And this particular piece I wrote for the American artist and sculptor named Peter Coyne, who was doing a big show at Massmoca. And the title of the show was Everything That Rises Must Converge, which oddly is a Flannery O'Connor book we all know and a Flannery O'Connor story.
By way of
Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who also weirdly was one of the people who unearthed Peking Man a gabillion years ago, which is just a very odd thing. And then stranger yet, there was a strike at this mill in North Adams, Massachusetts many years ago. And to break the strike, the mill brought in Chinese workers from San Francisco. So it is this peculiar weave of fact and fiction and Peter Coyne, the artist's love for Eastern art and Chinese culture, and my great-grandparents having a farm in North Adams, Massachusetts. And that's, I mean, to me, and I'm so glad that you love that story because it's such a special one and it took forever to make because it really is just a weave.
Yes, well, I think, like many stories now, in the culture of too much information, we have to take what we know and decide what to do with it.
Right.
What if instead of putting it in the attic or the basement, what if we were to find a place for it in a story? And what if the story, improbable as it seems, were to lead to a levitation into the sky of one of its characters who, having told all of her secrets, because that's what stories are, the telling of secrets, long-held secrets. What if now that we've told the secrets, we're to let them go? I was flabbergasted because in addition to everything else, the story is, like almost all the stories in the book, very funny. And I'd say that there's an arc in the book between realism. The first mm-hmm. story is a realistic story. It appeared in The New Yorker, of course. And the last stories are the fabulous death of the parents in the house with the regulated temperature, and the one before that, the Chinese mm-hmm. story, in which we understand the marriage and weaving of Chinese and American culture. If you guys don't do it, my story will,
right.
says A.M. Holmes. I will bring the cultures together.
But, you know, it also is funny because on the one hand, you know, Nixon was sort of the president of my first consciousness, I would say. And I grew up in Washington, D.C. So I remember I was at the zoo the day the pandas came and was on TV with Mrs. Nixon and these pandas. And I remember even this person saying, what do you think of the pandas? And I was saying, they're not very big, because you think of a panda bear as like this big bear. And it was a little, you know, like 3 feet tall. So that always that absurdity and that The magical realism, honestly, of growing up in Washington, D.C. was enough to get started on.
Failures of scale. I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with A.M. Holmes about her new book of short stories, Days of Awe. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with A.M. Holmes about her book of stories, Days of Awe, where characters don't quite turn out who they hope to be, and they can't escape from who they are. And one of the acknowledgments in Days of Awe is to A.M. Holmes' father, who worked as a museum guard at a Washington art museum, and he would take her to the museum. From that special point of view, he would tell us what Matisse looked like when he'd examine how his paintings were being hung in the museum. And those of us, I suspect you as well, who come to love art but from a skewed perspective. We weren't supposed to come from art families. We were the children of museum guards. You know, or as the people in the first story say, they're the children of butchers and artists. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Who are we? What are our inheritances? How do we deserve what we've come to inherit? These are the subjects, the inside subjects, the undersubjects of these stories, Days of Awe. And this is atonement, yeah?
I think it is that complicated thing of both making peace with a history that you may not have wanted to inherit and may have tried. I think I'm always fascinated how we can actively try to hold off our past or hold off what we know, but we don't want to admit that we know about ourselves, about our families.
You are the daughter of your father's mistress.
Mm-hmm. Not the father who was an artist and a museum guard.
No.
The father, my biological father, who was a banker.
Yes. And make of it what you will. You want to write an autobiography about this? You want to tell the story? You do it at your own peril, but go ahead.
Right.
Sure, A.M., tell us everything. And in the process, you see, this is what I mean when I say that your stories make me sick to my stomach. You dare to tell the stories that many of us are afraid of. You know, what if it turns out that we come from families who are definitely not the people who we would choose as our ancestors? What if the people we fall in love with are exactly not the people who deserve our love? And what do we do about that because it is true?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think I do often write about things that other people wouldn't. And I somehow feel that's sort of my job. But part of it also is I feel like whatever skill I have as a writer, I want to make sure that these stories are known and are out there so that people find themselves in them, so that people find their own reflection, whether it is a reflection of another person who was adopted or was given up for adoption, who hasn't even had a chance to discover how you articulate what that dissonance is in your own life.
Well, it's sort of like whoever you are, no matter what you want to say, you don't really know who you are. And fiction, reading fiction, especially fiction that pulls the rug out from under you, fiction tells you how it can be that you don't know the most basic things about yourself. And it's a very exciting thing because I think one of the developments in contemporary fiction, in the fiction of our time, is to figure out how to write a story where the reader thinks, I know the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't. I know when the story takes place.
Right.
No, you don't. I know who all the characters are. Oh, well, you thought so for the first five pages.
Mm-hmm.
What if everything starts to lose weight and to float, and in the process of losing weight, gains profundity and meaning?
Well, that would be what fiction is good for. And I think we live in such a peculiar time because often when I'm on book tour and things, people will say, I read your new novel, so it's all true? And I'm thinking, no, that's called nonfiction. But the idea that right now people don't know the difference between fiction and nonfiction, and that we have these very peculiar ideas of truth and so on, I think it's really important to remember and to recognize what an imagination is, and importantly, along the lines of what you're saying, the power of an imagination to render kinds of experience and truth with quotation marks around it that is not about fact, but is about feeling and the experience of the heart.
This is where the compassion comes in, really. I've been talking with A.M. Holmes, author of Days of Awe. It's published by Viking. I haven't had A.M. Holmes on my show for nearly 30 years. That's going to be rectified starting today. Thank you for joining me.
I'm so glad to see you, Michael.
It's a pleasure. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from Apple Podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Michelle Escobar. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Lauren Groff is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.